Well, thanks a lot for having me. It's always nice speaking to y'all. I actually don't think I've spoken at the Aspen conference. I've been in Key West. And so it's nice to see the friendly faces out here. The way I typically do these presentations is that out of the 50 minutes or so I'm allotted, I'll probably just talk for 25 minutes or whatever. You don't really want to hear me talk longer than that. I'd like to have some time after that, though, for like a real dialogue about some of this stuff. I actually came with a couple of questions, things that I've been trying to think about and thought maybe y'all can help me and all of us think through some of this together. I also just want to quickly thank Danica, who allowed me to switch slots with her, which will allow me to get home tonight. So thank you. So I'm here to talk about really two sets of cases. The first set of cases are the RICO matters that were filed to much publicity last year. There were two of those cases. I litigated one of those cases defending the one of the main defendants or two of the main defendants in the Frisco matter, the Holiday Inn matter. And there's one other set of cases, one other RICO case that I'm going to spend some time talking about as well. The second set of cases is also one that has received a fair amount of public attention, and that was the case filed in the U.S. Supreme Court, or that was attempted to be filed in the U.S. Supreme Court by the states of Nebraska and Oklahoma, filed against the state of Colorado. So I'm going to go through those cases, talk a little bit about some of our experiences, particularly in the Frisco case, which is the Holiday Inn case. But I thought maybe before doing that, let me try to make a few observations about these cases, some things maybe to keep in mind as we go through them. First, and this is probably not going to surprise any of you, I think these cases are pretty scary. You know, there have been no attempts to hide the fact that these cases were filed with the intention of overturning Colorado's laws. That's what this was about. And with that, not just to overturn Colorado's laws, but to really roll back so much of the progress that has been made over the last, you know, 20 years, 25 years. If those cases, the three I'm talking about today, were successful, or to the extent they're still going on, are going to be successful, I think there would be at least three major consequences. The first is that Colorado's laws would be struck down or rescinded or eviscerated to a large degree. Second, the laws of other marijuana-friendly states would surely be targeted. The plaintiffs in these cases surely were hoping for a domino effect that would resonate around the country. Third, these lawsuits, again, just if they were successful, would really be Exhibit A in the legislatures of all the other states that are considering making their marijuana laws more progressive. Second, on the whole, and this is going to maybe be a little bit controversial, but on the whole, I actually think these cases are a good thing. And bear with me for a minute. Let me just start by saying these are the three cases that we're talking about here. The first two are the RICO cases. Safe Streets Alliance were the plaintiffs in both of them. The one I litigated was the first one, Medical Marijuana of the Rockies. And the second one, which we'll also talk about, is the Alternative Holistic Healing case. The Supreme Court case I mentioned is Nebraska and Oklahoma v. Colorado. So I was on point two here, which is maybe these cases are not such a bad thing. And Paul is looking skeptically and reasonably so at that. Let me try to break that down a little bit. For some time, our side had been trying to figure out affirmative cases to advance the ball down the road to legalization. And the reason for that, or at least one of the reasons for that, could have been that political progress, legislative progress, was not quite as fast as we would have liked it to have been. And having been involved in the discussions about bringing some of those potential affirmative cases, the idea is that maybe it was time to start seeking some redress through the judiciary. I personally was always a little bit skeptical of that, but that was at least one of the theories behind bringing some of these affirmative cases. But the filing of affirmative cases now by the bad guys, I actually think is an important turning point. Because I think, if I'm reading into this right, they see that the political winds are turning against them. That they're starting to lose. That they're not just starting to lose, but they're going to start to lose significantly further over the next couple of years, too. And barring some disastrous court ruling, which I think is increasingly looking unlikely, I hope we're continuing down the path toward legalization. So if the paradigm that I set up a few minutes ago is correct, that we were originally trying to bring some of these affirmative cases, because we weren't getting as much traction or as much quick traction as we would have hoped, maybe the exact opposite now is true. Maybe the bad guys are bringing these cases because they know they're doomed at the ballot box. They know they're doomed in the legislative halls over time. And so if they can finally and firmly and fully shut the door through an unelected branch, that might be their last best hope. I don't want to be too Pollyannish about it. We do need to remain vigilant in parrying these strikes. But for a long-term view of marijuana law and policy, I can actually see these cases as a good sign. Third, the third point really is a more retail-oriented point, which is that the litigating of Jerry Olson's case and the RICO case in Frisco got me thinking a lot about funding. I became extremely concerned about some aspects of the industry when I was defending Jerry in this case. Nobody was willing to fund Jerry's case. And I am perfectly fine doing cases pro bono. That's okay. And I certainly do a fair amount of that. So this isn't just, you know, fetching for me. But it really made me think about who is going to pay for the defense of these important cases. And if the industry, as I'm positing here, has such an interest in these cases turning out right, I really do think that they need to step up to the plate and provide some funding for these types of cases. And so one of the things that I've been thinking about recently, and I would be happy to talk with you all about this after the talk, or you know, my contact info is up and it'll be in the last slide too if you want to talk about it, is the idea of putting together some sort of legal defense fund. I think there should be enough political and economic interest in making that happen. I can tell you from my experience of litigating Jerry's case, while the money surely is there to make it happen, the interest was not there to make it happen. So again, not complaining for me personally about doing this pro bono, but a little bit of a concern about what that means if people aren't willing to step up to the plate to do it pro bono in a good way, and you need the money to actually litigate these cases. So let's start talking about those three, and the first of the three, Safe Streets Alliance versus Medical Marijuana of the Rockies. So Jerry Olson was the owner of Medical Marijuana of the Rockies. It was based in Frisco, Colorado, which is, about 10 miles from Breckenridge. He owned a store. He owned and operated a store. It had been doing fairly well, fairly successful for a number of years, and Jerry decided that he wanted to move his shop. And so he entered into an intent to purchase a building that was much closer to the freeway entrance. And it would have been a much larger building, a much bigger footprint for Jerry. Things seemed to be going, at least according to plan, and Jerry was working through the financing of this. He was hit with a lawsuit. The building adjacent to the building he was going to purchase filed this lawsuit, alleging that Jerry and a bunch of people he had been doing business with were racketeers under RICO. The building adjacent to Jerry's building was the Holiday Inn. So the Holiday Inn of Frisco brought this case. The Holiday Inn, mind you, that for some time had been receiving payments from a group of physicians to conduct consultations on the Holiday Inn's property, nonetheless filed this RICO case against Jerry. We're going to talk about some of the... Yeah, please.
We're talking federal RICO, not state.
Correct. Correct, absolutely. And so this was filed in federal court in the District of Colorado as a federal civil case. RICO has both a civil and a criminal component to it. This was the civil side. The case was filed not just against Jerry, but it was filed against the owner and seller of the building he was trying to acquire. It was filed against the individual who loaned Jerry money, right? And we're not talking about a big shop here. The guy apparently loaned Jerry $35,000. And as a result of that, this person got hit with a RICO lawsuit, which could have resulted in serious ruin for him in a whole lot of ways. They filed the case against Jerry's bank, against the construction worker who was working on the building to build it out for Jerry, against the bonding company, and against Jerry's accountant. We're going to talk a little bit in a few minutes just about the implications of that. And one of the things that I want to think about with all of you is whether we as attorneys, is everybody here an attorney, or most people here are attorneys? Whether we as an attorney actually may have to worry about this ourselves. I think it's an interesting question. So the idea behind the case is simple, and in my mind, it's a little frighteningly simple. The main RICO statute, 18 U.S.C. 1962, prohibits two or more people from conspiring to violate any number of laws, right? And it specifies a number of them, and some of them are a little less specific. But in the case of RICO, it actually does, I have most of these up on a slide, not this particular one. The RICO statute does define racketeering activity to include, among other things, dealing in a controlled substance or listed chemical under the CSA, or the felonious manufacture, importation, receiving, concealment, buying, selling, or otherwise dealing in a controlled substance. So at least on the surface, that would seem to cover the type of things that Jerry was alleged to be doing. I think one could try to make some arguments around that, but at least on the surface, that did seem to apply. Fair enough, I guess. But as I saw this case, we did at least have an ace in the hole, which is the Supreme Court's recent standing doctrine regarding RICO. And it's one of those instances where all of these, we have the U.S. Chamber of Commerce to thank for this. You know, all of these conservative corporate entities have actually made serious inroads with the U.S. Supreme Court in trying to trim or narrow down the scope of RICO liability. And while that has bedeviled plaintiff's lawyers over the years, it actually has worked wonders for Jerry Olson. So RICO creates a private right of action for, quote, any person injured in his business or property by reason of racketeering activity. Okay? So the key words here are by reason of. Those three little words have spawned, I don't know, probably half a dozen Supreme Court cases. What does it mean to be injured by reason of activity? Because it's some, you know, you have a spectrum, right? And this is like all of your causation cases that you may have. At one end of the spectrum, causation could not be any more clear. On the other end, it's rather attenuated, and you have, you know, five different steps or five different people it needs to go through until you have an injury. And what the Supreme Court has said is that it's over here, that it's a very narrow understanding or interpretation of causation. So the Supreme Court has said that by reason of, which the Supreme Court calls RICO proximate cause, you need to have a proximate cause or a direct injury. Okay? It needs to be the direct result. And there just needs to be one single step between the action and the injury. So far from, if you remember our spectrum here, right? Far from over here where you have, you know, four or five people touching this thing, you need to have one activity and that directly leading to injury. Now, this is what we wrote in Jerry's brief. That the civil RICO plaintiff must be the, quote, direct victim or the intended target of defendant's conduct. That's what the Supreme Court has said over the years. Now, that is a pretty stringent standard. You do not find such difficult causation standard in most federal statutes. And how did that play out in Jerry's case? Did anybody know what the alleged harm was to the plaintiff in this case, to the Holiday Inn? That pretty much is the other RICO case that I'm going to talk about. It's a very good point. So sort of closely associated with the hotel room prices is that they were losing customers, right? That they had a couple of high school ski teams that were coming in that had heard about this from God knows where and called up the hotel and decided to cancel their annual reservations. The other potential harm that they alleged to have suffered is that they had then spent money to mitigate the harm that they had thought maybe was going to befall them through Jerry's store. Now, that doesn't really fit neatly into the RICO proximate cause analysis. Certainly the Holiday Inn was not the, quote, intended target of Jerry's business, right? And it wasn't really fulfilling the, quote, the requisite single step between the action and their harm. At the very least, there was one other step, which is that somebody needed to read about this, call up the hotel, and cancel their reservations. So at the very least, you had two steps there. We actually argued it was four or five steps. But, yes?
But is that a net loss or one person saying it?
Good. So I was going to get there, but let's jump ahead. No. So when you're talking about, what do you have in mind?
What I have in mind is you'll have some organizations that say, okay, I don't want kids around there. But you'll have other organizations say, hey, fantastic, you're right next door. Now I'm coming in and we're
right.
Going to end up making.
Exactly. And so one of the things that I was, all right, spoiler alert, we won. They dismissed the case. And one of the reasons that I think they dismissed the case, and I'm getting to your point right now, is that we propounded some discovery that was aimed at exactly that. And I think it was going to be, Paul, we talked about this, I think. It was going to be super interesting to try to develop some evidentiary basis to say, hardly losing money, the Holiday Inn was going to win, right? It was going to be a net positive. And I think that the forces behind this that were paying for the Holiday Inn's case was actually concerned that what was going to develop out of these cases was not just a loss, was not just a ruling saying that there's no proximate cause, that there's no civil RICO liability, but some finding by the court that Jerry's business was actually economically beneficial. And so I had a number of really interesting conversations with potential experts about how would you demonstrate a model for showing that Jerry's business was going to have a net positive result on the Holiday Inn. From a legal standpoint, from an expert law standpoint, it's a fairly challenging thing to do, but one can do that. There's certainly, you know, econometricians who could figure that out. And there's an emerging body of scholarship about the effects of more liberalized marijuana laws. And it would have been a super interesting discovery battle. And ultimately, I think that may have been one of the things, at least, that led them to dismiss the case against Jerry. Let me go back to sort of this proximate cause thing. And the reason I am perseverating on this a bit is that I think it is super important as more of these RICO cases get filed, and more of them will get filed, for us to have an answer to the following question. The main response from the Holiday Inn regarding this proximate cause issue was, listen, RICO explicitly says that it applies to violations of the CSA. If you have this stringent standard that you're trying to apply to marijuana-related RICO offenses, you're basically saying civil RICO can never apply, right? That it's an empty set because the plaintiff is never the intended target, okay? It is actually a very interesting question in my mind, although I'm probably just a dork. I spent quite a bit of time trying to figure out what would be a likely, what would be a marijuana enterprise that could lead to RICO liability satisfying proximate cause. And so I would love for somebody to come up with an example. I think it would be helpful to know. I've maybe come up with one or two. Go on. Go for it.
So that who can't open? So you think that then the competitor, it would be, yeah, there would be an unclean hands issue with that. It's a clever thought. Yeah. What else?
Pharmaceutical.
Okay, good. I've been trying to think about this. What, in what way?
Well, to me, if you're going after, you would fit a niche here of paying relief from the seizure relief. You've got those pharmaceutical monopoly at market, but I don't think a single business basis.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's right. I think you would also potentially face the single step issue because you would have other actors that are playing some role in that between the actions of the alleged, Absolutely. I think you would also have a hard time saying that the pharmaceutical industry was the intended target of, well, I don't know. Maybe not. I don't know. That's interesting.
Medicine,
yeah. That's an interesting idea. Okay. Yeah.
A pain clinic.
Yep.
Uh-huh. That's not a bad idea, too. That's possible.
I was trying to think of a situation where maybe there was a grow operation that was transgressing on somebody else's land. You're growing on your neighbor's land. And that it does seem then that they are the intended target. It does seem that there is not another actor involved.
Isn't that more of an adverse possession issue? I mean, it's literally just an acre. Uh-huh. It's all in that way. I don't see that being a
reason. Well, I mean, the question then would be whether that is an injury to that person's property,
sure.
Right? There needs to be an injury to business or property. Anyway, I think it's an interesting question, and one that we'll probably need to ponder as more of these civil RICO cases are filed. Now, I mentioned how we more or less won because they dropped the case. Let me step back from that just a touch and say that we also lost in some ways. I mentioned before how there were they filed this case against – well, we lost in a few ways. One is with the filing of the case, there was a lot of publicity around this. And I think that in and of itself probably created a bit of a chilling effect. If you're a small bonding company and you see your competitor bonding company getting sued for RICO, you may exit the industry. Or as another example, you're a small-time bank. You're a community bank. And you're worried that you're going to get hit with RICO liability, be hit with treble damages, worried about the feds going after you. I think there is a significant chilling effect that comes around from the publicity of the filing of the case, regardless of what happened with it. Second, I mentioned before there were all these defendants, and many of them settled. And, you know, I don't begrudge that. I get it. They settled probably for very small sums of money. But one of the provisions of the settlement agreement is that they're not going to re-enter the industry. And so these, you know, I think in the end that did have a pretty detrimental impact, even though it's a technical matter we won the case. More than a technical matter. I mean, I think we did win the case, but there were some downsides to this as well. I want to stick with the ancillary players for a bit. And one of the things that, because I really felt bad for those folks. I mean, I felt bad for Jerry and his company for sure. I also felt bad for his accountant. That guy was just providing regular accounting advice for this company, just like he did for lots of other companies. And all of a sudden he gets hit with a RICO case. There's really no logical stopping point to their argument, because what they were saying is that anybody could end up as a RICO defendant when you're helping a marijuana business, you know it's a marijuana business, and your actions are important for the furtherance of that business. What's that? Ah, exactly. So, hold on 1 second. And so, you know, if that's the understanding of this, why not the UPS delivery person, right? Why not the guy who shoveled Jerry's driveway when it snowed? Why not lawyers? Now, my firm was fine doing this and wasn't really worried about the exposure from this for lots of reasons. But, you know, what about a transactional attorney? You know, the person, you know, you have to comply with various regulations, get permits. All of that requires paperwork and filling in, many of which you end up using an attorney. Under their understanding of how you can get co-conspirator RICO liability, that's okay. I think that's a real problem and cause for concern. You had a question.
Not really. Is there an option to file a prosecutor cover the attorney's fees in a situation?
So the question is, you know, can they feel any pain?
Yes.
from filing this frivolous case? And the answer is that it really does need to rise to the level of frivolousness. There is a fee-shifting provision, as there are, let's say, in, you know, our civil rights laws, when you prevail on a case. But just like in the civil rights laws, where you don't have a reciprocal or bilateral fee-shifting agreement, fee-shifting arrangement, the same is true under RICO. And the idea behind both of those is the same, which is that you want to encourage people to bring those kinds of cases. You want to encourage people to vindicate their rights. And so, the only way you can get fees out of this through the RICO statute is if you can demonstrate their case was so frivolous that it should.
Yeah. So I guess
yep.
The question is, who funded that? Because I would certainly take it on a contingency.
Sure.
So can you file a civil RICO again for whatever racketeering transfer?
I have thought long and hard about this. We have not done it yet.
Russia sued J.P. Morgan in the civil.
Who did it?
Russia.
Okay.
It took several years along with J.P.
Morgan. Right.
The Russians solved it. Who knows?
We've also thought about who funded these cases, because it clearly wasn't the Holiday Inn. You know, the cases, both RICO cases, were brought by a very prominent, well-known Washington, D.C. law firm. They were good lawyers. I happen to think they were wrong here, but they were good lawyers. And they surely were not doing this as a pro bono matter. I have heard some various speculation about who was funding these cases, but I really don't know the answer to that. Surely somebody has been funding it, though. Yep. So we were talking about lawyers for a minute. Let me just stick with that. You know, my prior office litigated the Conant v. Walters case, which was the medical marijuana case out of California where the feds were threatening to go after physicians, take away their licenses because they were recommending marijuana. And one of the issues that came up in that case is, you know, do you have First Amendment protections if the physicians are violating the law? I'm going to bring this back to the lawyer issue here. Ultimately, the Ninth Circuit kind of ducked that question. And said it didn't really matter for various reasons. But here too, I wonder, you know, could somebody say, you know, my first response thinking about whether lawyers can be on the hook for this is say, well, they have First Amendment protections, right? The Supreme Court has had a number of cases upholding the First Amendment rights of attorneys. On the other hand, you don't have First Amendment rights to do anything. I mean, to do just anything you'd like. You know, there are carve outs for certain illegal activities. And so then it raises a question, I think, of are transactional attorneys violating the law in any way, aiding and abetting, facilitating crimes by acting as the transactional attorneys for these businesses? I know you all have thought long and hard about this in other contexts, and that could be a separate discussion or entire day of discussions. But as I have been thinking through this issue and thinking about what are attorneys' potential liability or exposure under civil RICO, these are the kind of things that I have been thinking about, and would be quite keen to continue those conversations with any of you who would like to. I think it's an important point for all of us. My leaning is that the courts would protect attorneys.
Right.
I think you could perhaps make some headway in the First Amendment. You could perhaps make some headway that the act itself is just not committing a crime. And so your escape, you have between the First Amendment rights and the not committing a crime, you're probably in the clear. I guess that is my instinct on it. Again, I wasn't too worried about this for our case because, I mean, they were, first of all, as a practical matter, they were not about to sue us for representing Jerry in the RICO case. That they just would have looked even more ridiculous doing that. In some ways, that would have been a welcome, not for me. So that is another, I wish I had more time to talk about this. This is being played out across state bars around the country. And I also think that is an incredibly important issue. To the extent that state bars have weighed in on a matter and said that you have some rights to do this, or you're within your ethical bounds to do this, I can't imagine getting tagged for liability. On the other hand, to the extent that the state bars have explicitly said, no, you can't do this, then I think that creates another hurdle. There was a question here.
Yeah, but this is in the civil context.
Right. Yep. Sure. I agree with that. I think there are slightly different considerations that come into play in the criminal context than the civil context for those reasons, but it's a point well taken.
Do you think the government has that trillion dollars that, what, does it not have enough? Really?
That's right. I think that's good. I mean, and the only thing perhaps more scary for the government than attorneys helping these folks do their business is these folks doing their business without attorneys. And it's just being even more of the wild, you know, the Wild West. This is great. Yeah.
Sorry. My quick point here is basically the difference in the application between criminal and civil. What do you say? I couldn't hear.
That's okay. The question was, or the point really was, you know, does this implicate or have effects on the Sixth Amendment right to counsel? That to the extent that you're, one would make the argument that these people don't have the right to counsel because, you know, by engaging in representation, let's say the transactional attorneys I was talking about, you are requiring them to be pro se. Yeah. There was another, yes. Terrific. Yeah. You have predicted. I was about to say you've predicted our third case we're going to talk about, which is the suit against the state of Colorado. Although, if you're talking about it in the context of RICO liability as a legal matter, actually governments can't be on the hook for RICO liability. So as a RICO matter, no. But as you know, potentially being subject to other types of claims or other suits. Absolutely, that's right. And back when I was at one point talking with some more progressive cities about how to implement, you know, a better marijuana scheme, and one of their concerns was, you know, can our people be arrested? Right? It's a legitimate concern. Yeah. There was one question over here. Maybe no. Okay. Let's go on to our second case. Okay. 10 minutes. All right. You're always best friends with the moderator until the moderator tells you no. All right. So there was a parallel RICO case that was filed. It was also filed by the same law firm out of D.C., also involved some of the same plaintiffs under a somewhat similar legal theory. And there are actually two parts to the case. The first is that, and somebody mentioned this before, it was a homeowner who had sued a business that was located nearby, saying that the business, the marijuana business, was depressing property values. And also that there was a noxious smell. Second, in this case, they sued the state and the county for the marijuana laws being preempted by the CSA. Let me start with preemption. That's a somewhat quicker conversation, at least for this case. I litigated a preemption case representing Normal, San Diego Normal, when the County of San Diego sued San Diego Normal and others, saying that California's marijuana laws were preempted by the CSA. We won that case. Won that case in the trial court, in the state court of appeals. The California Supreme Court and the U.S. Supreme Court denied review. There are some really interesting preemption issues that come up, but in this particular case, that legal issue was far less interesting because in the middle of the case, the U.S. Supreme Court issued an opinion called the Armstrong opinion that basically said that there's no private right of action to bring preemption claims. They'll argue at the margins that that shouldn't apply here, although I really do think it does and should apply. And so I think in this case, at least, preemption is not such an interesting issue. Moving on to the RICO case, though, the RICO claims, the district court dismissed those claims. It started by recognizing the, quote, inherent conflict between the CSA and Colorado's marijuana laws. And that was at the heart of the RICO claims. I mean, I agree with that. That is at the heart of the RICO claims. And I don't think we can really run from that. I mean, that is largely true. There are differences. And these legal issues are going to arise and going to continue to arise until those laws are more consonant. That's going to happen. But in this particular case, just like the case I talked about representing Jerry, they again ran into proximate cause issues and RICO standing issues. This is what they said in their complaint, that their plaintiffs live near the licensed marijuana business and it brought a criminal element into the neighborhood and caused traffic congestion. By causing these problems, the state's decision to license the business has substantially damaged the value of surrounding properties. And what the court said is that you need to have a concrete financial loss. And it can't be just an injury to sort of this inchoate or intangible property interest. And so the court just said, again, this is on injury grounds. It just wasn't enough. And this comes back to our prior conversation where we were trying to say, what is enough? What would actually be a cognizable RICO claim that's related to marijuana? This was not it. There was no injury to business. There was no business involved. They also said that there was no injury to property. As a postscript, the plaintiffs have filed a motion for reconsideration that's currently pending in the District of Colorado. I am sure that will be appealed, just like the plaintiffs appealed the dismissal of their preemption claim. So this is all working its way up to the 10th Circuit. And who shows up in the 10th Circuit to intervene? That is the states of Oklahoma and Nebraska, which brings us to our third case. So in Nebraska and Oklahoma v. Colorado, these two states, Nebraska and Oklahoma, had asked the U.S. Supreme Court to entertain a case under its, quote, original jurisdiction. Original jurisdiction, I've never litigated one of these cases. It's where you have one state suing another. Typically, that's how it works. There are a couple of other, I think you said 20 minutes. Good. I'll be quick. And the idea is that the Nebraska and Oklahoma sued Colorado to enjoin the purported harm that was befalling those states as a result of Colorado's laws. What they were saying is that they were needed to devote a lot more resources to marijuana-related activity, that you had all of this demon weed coming in to Nebraska and Oklahoma by way of Colorado, and it was really hurting them. I also thought it was interesting in their Supreme Court complaint, and I bolded this language, that according to Nebraska and Oklahoma, it's the Colorado state and local officials who are now required to violate the CSA. And that goes back to a point that somebody made over here about whether government officials can actually be responsible, if you will, or legally responsible, criminally responsible for this. I know I have a couple minutes. Let me try to fast forward. The Supreme Court ultimately denied review of the case. There is a hot, interesting debate about whether the Supreme Court has the ability to do that. And in fact, Nebraska and Oklahoma were saying that it did not. I wanted to get there. We won't. They said that the plaintiff states have no adequate alternative remedies to enforce their rights and that the Supreme Court had exclusive jurisdiction. They are now in a pickle because after the Supreme Court denied review, where do they go? They've already said the Supreme Court's the only place they could hear this case. And so what they've attempted to do, and I appreciate their creativity, if nothing else, is that they have sought to intervene in the Tenth Circuit case that has now been appealed from the second RICO case. So in the second RICO case, remember, there was a preemption claim, and that was dismissed, and then that was appealed. And so those preemption issues are up at the Tenth Circuit, and Nebraska and Oklahoma have asked to join that portion of the appeal. Okay. I believe the opening brief is due in that case tomorrow, which means that we will probably get a ruling, probably, I would imagine, sometime late 17. So let's see. I had a lot more I wanted to say about this, but I'm going to not do that. And I apologize for taking so much time, and say that as all of these cases wind their way through the judicial system, I think it's important for us to be aware of them, to parry these attacks when they come up, to make our clients aware that this, I think we have a responsibility of making our clients aware that this is a possibility, and yet to do that in a way that hopefully makes it that it's not too scary, right? And that is, if you believe that this shouldn't be too scary, I guess I kind of previewed what I thought here. I really think these cases are losers, but they're possible. And I think it's incumbent upon all of us to understand what those possibilities are out there so we can advise our clients accordingly. So thank you very much. I appreciate it.